Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 6th of September 2013 here in the sunny climes of Western Japan. And today we're joined from the rainy climes of Western United States by our good friend and the host and proprietor of BoilingFrogsPost.com, none other than Sibel Edmonds. Sibel, always great to have you on the program. Thank you so much for your time today.
And thank you for having me, James.
Well, this is a very important time geopolitically, just with so many things happening in the world right now, and of course the G20 that's ongoing that may or may not come to some sort of conclusions about where the world is heading geopolitically. And on that note, we have a very interesting breaking report from BoilingFrogsPost.com that I will direct people's attention to. Obama may have come up with the needed bone for Russia on Syria, and this is something that obviously we've talked about before in the past, including with our coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing and the geopolitical implications of that. But very briefly, would you like to tell people about this article and what you're covering?
Sure. As we just mentioned, we have been covering it. We started this coverage after the Boston terror attack and the whole issue of Chechnya suddenly becoming a hot topic here in the United States. And all along, we were expecting that we were going to have this escalated with the United States, because the plans to attack Syria, the regime change in Syria, had basically been in play, has been in operation since spring 2011. I mean, we were the first at Boiling Frogs Post to report the Turkish base there, the U.S. base in Turkey, Incirlik base, being used to train and orchestrate all these coordination with the rebels, the terrorists in Syria, and all the activities cross-border. And one of the issues that we had discussed had to do with Russia and Russia's position in this whole scenario and what's happening between U.S. and the, basically NATO, U.S. and Syria. And Russia has been playing tough. They have actually been talking tough, and to a certain degree, they have been acting tough, not as much as the media has been reflecting. For example, there has been all these big announcements on the deliveries of, et cetera, missiles to Syria by Russia. But if you go really look at the facts, they haven't delivered anything yet. You know, it hasn't actually been delivered. Just the fact that that order has been placed by Assad's government, and Russia has not delivered it yet. So how much of it is talk, how much of it is inaction? And of course, as it's the case always with the international, the chess game with these leaders, whether it's Russia or United States, you're looking at the situation where people want to flex muscle and say, well, okay, what's in there for me? And with everything that has been cooking up between the United States and Russia in terms of tension, you know, we are looking at issues like Georgia's candidacy and basically imminent membership of NATO. That has been a very, very hot topic for Russia. And for U.S. being so determined to attack Syria and have this regime change, as we did, you know, with Libya, but to put it in really full force mode, Russia has been the only single obstacle, because people talk about the public opinion in the United States, but when it comes down to it, it's not that, because, you know, since when we have really cared about the public opinion as far as the government or the administration is concerned. Now, with this case, it would come down to what would it take for Russia to look the other way and say, fine, go ahead and do it. Well, there has to be some attractive bones for Russia. And usually people say, well, you know, Russia doesn't need U.S. money or U.S. aid, and that's just ridiculous. But that's not the case. I mean, when you're looking at the international relations and all the strategic positionings, there are things that people give each other, meaning when I say people, it's Russia and the United States. And one hot topic currently, or has been, not currently, since 2008, has been Georgia's full membership of NATO. And this is a very, very sensitive, hot topic for the Russian side. And we have always been, the United States, you know, supporting Georgia and everything. So we have been using, as we have been using other actors in the region against Russia, by bringing them into our camp, meaning the NATO camp, the Western camp. Well, lo and behold, just a few weeks ago, all these U.S. and Western world-related NGOs, and investigative media sites such as Eurasia.net, they started putting out these reports going back 1 year, saying that, in fact, the previous administration in Georgia, and that is Saakashvili, Saakashvili's government, they recruited and trained the Chechens for terrorism against Russia, trying to basically attack Russia through supporting and training and recruiting these Chechen terrorist groups. Now, this is incredible. We have known about all this. That's you, that's me, that's alternative media, and even to a certain degree, some UK publications. This on and off, you know, Georgia's involvement with the Chechens, as with Azerbaijan, in terms of training and recruiting terrorists to be used against Russia. But we never got to see that coming from the Western media, Western NGOs, Western think tank. So to see that happening right now, just recently, and this coinciding with our basically last stage to have the direct attack on Syria. We have been attacking Syria for the past 2.5 years. And again, the G20 summit and with all the tough talks between Russia and U.S. strongly points to this possibility that this may be one of those cases. Because not only that, with the reports on the previous administration in Georgia a year ago recruiting and training Chechnya, but also when you're looking at some of the right-leaning, neocon, hawkish, imperialistic websites, in the past month or so, you keep coming across these articles, these editorials, talking about, maybe it's not a good idea to have Georgia as a NATO member and as a partner. Maybe Georgia will be more of a liability instead of beneficial, you know, Georgia's membership for the United States and for NATO. And this, again, is new because the same exact people, up until about a year ago, they were busy writing about the importance of bringing Georgia and having Georgia being, you know, our tool against Russia and encountering Russia. And yet they have made this incredibly sudden turn in now considering poo-pooing all those qualifications that were good for the United States to be the bad ones at Georgia's liability. So when you put all these together and with what we know with U.S. sponsorship of terrorism against Russia, especially the Chechen forces, the Chechen terrorist groups, And what's happening now with these reports with Georgia, of course, they wouldn't touch the current administration. He's our boy. He's a current boy. You know, our previous boy there, Saakashvili. Well, you put all this together with G20 summit and what's happening with Russia, that makes the likelihood, for me at least, and for maybe some of those other people who have been looking at that side of the world, which the U.S. media hasn't been doing, very interesting and a big possibility as a bargaining chip, as a token, and that would be having saying, okay, Russia, fine. We'll delay Georgia's full membership maybe for another 8 or 10 years. Plus, you know, with what happened with the Boston terror attack, we have had this common enemy that we set up as a scenario. And we, the international community, even though this is going to be right along the borders of the sensitive borders, we will look the other way. You conduct, you know, more severe operations against some of our terror groups, you know? We are very good at that. We train and we put in place, we support and we orchestrate these terrorist groups, but sometimes we give them up. You know, whether it's Mojahideen Khalq, the MKO, or other words, MEK, against Iran. They are sometimes in our terrorist list when it's convenient, and sometimes we just want to say we need to remove that terrorist label and we need to overtly support them. This is no different. And this, by this, I mean with the Chechens, and right now it's what's happening in Georgia. We say, fine, you know what? We won't have Georgia as member, and we will withdraw our support of the Chechen groups, and we look the other way, green light for you, you go do all the stuff, and we say you're justified. Because, look, they conducted this terror operations here in the United States, in the Western world. That, again, makes it highly likely. I know after we aired our segments, a few months later, people start coming and saying, see, Russia still is tough, James and Sabelle, those predictions did not come true. again, this is a very particular American trait, and that is short-term looking at things, being very impatient, the instant gratification, you know, those things are just have become such a classic trait for many, many Americans here. You have to look at the big picture and see what has been happening. For example, we had this NSA scandal breaking. Sometimes other scandals come and delay other things. Right in the midst of all the Snowden scandals, it would not have been really that good for Obama to tackle Syria. It would be just too classic of a wag the dog situation. So that put on this pause mode for a couple of months because we were predicting this exact same thing to happen 2 months ago. But it's happening right now. Eventually, these things happen because, again, this establishes this modus operandi. But again, it comes down to Russia. And if we were to see, and I expect this, I still do expect it, okay? I'm not looking into this crystal ball. I may be proved wrong. But if we see Russia finally sidestep, and even though while they're talking really tough, don't do anything about our very soon to come aggression war against Syria, then you got to start saying, what did we give to Russians to do that? Because it's always a matter of give and take between superpowers. So what did we give? I would say the whole issue of Chechen, Dagestan, Chechnya region, and also Georgia's NATO membership would be a good bet to look at and count on.
Well, it is a fascinating and detailed analysis, and it does square with what I've been seeing of the way that Georgia has really been fed to the wolves or laid by the wayside by the U.S. that had been so heavily promoting it as a future NATO member. So I think this is an absolutely spot-on analysis and very important. I hope people will take a look at it. It's at the top of BoilingFrogsPost.com right now. Again, under the headline, Obama may have come up with the needed bone for Russia on Syria. But in fact, Sibel, it was not about the current ongoing geopolitical situation that I wanted to have you on today. It's actually in regards to the upcoming 12th anniversary of the 9/11 events that I wanted to talk to you specifically about something that I'm covering right now extensively through the podcast in a recent conversation that I had with researcher Jeremy Reese, for example, and an upcoming conversation that I'm going to be having with Kevin Ryan, who has written the indispensable book Another 19, looking at other legitimate 9/11 suspects other than the 19 alleged hijackers. And it's in that regard that I wanted to talk to you today about the information that you came across, of course, as your time at the FBI and what you've uncovered since then in your research about people inside the U.S. government who may have had a hand in facilitating or allowing or understanding or setting up the framework for those 9/11 attacks. And it's obviously, I mean, there's so incredibly much to go through that it's difficult to limit this down. But today I wanted to concentrate on some people associated with the State Department who I think are people of interest in this regard, some of whom you had direct knowledge of with regards to your work and others not so, but who are still interesting in and of themselves. And the three that I'm interested perhaps most in talking about today are Richard Armitage, who at the time of 9/11 was working as the Deputy Secretary of State under Colin Powell. Also Mark Grossman, who figures prominently in your testimony regarding your case, who at the time of 9/11 was the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. And also Richard Holbrooke, who basically Mark Grossman took over his old position at the State Department as the Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs back in the mid-1990s. He was succeeded by Mark Grossman in that position. So these are three people who are interesting. There's another that I want to throw into the mix to ask you about to see if you have any knowledge of. But let's start with these three characters and their positions in the State Department, not only at the time of 9/11, but of course in the years preceding 9/11, they also served important public positions that really did put them in the midst of things. And perhaps the most important part of all of this is their positions in various lobbying organizations. And of course, that's been reflected in the years since, with Richard Armitage becoming the chairman of the board of the American Turkish Council, another entity that figures very heavily in your story. So I'm not sure where you'd like to pick up the thread of this story, but perhaps we can start start by talking a little bit about Richard Armitage, who I know you have covered at BoilingFrogsPost.com. Not only yourself, but contributors to the blog have talked about Armitage and his checkered past, including time in Vietnam that includes allegations of drug smuggling and money laundering. Let's talk about Armitage and his position at the State Department at the time of 9/11.
Sure, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned because Minsky and Yilmaz had a three-part series, excellent, excellent series on Armitage, Richard Armitage. And again, it started from 1970s and his various positions and scandals. And I will start by saying this. Nobody should ever say what scandals, major scandals, Richard Armitage was part of. They should actually ask it the other way, another way, with, which would be a much better way, and saying, has there been any major scandals that Richard Armitage hasn't been a part of? So that would be a far more appropriate appropriate question for Richard Armitage, because when you start following Richard Armitage's career with the government and his involvements in various operations and scandals, that's when you realize the importance, okay, the significance of Richard Armitage. And you start with 1970s, when he was with the Naval Academy, and that was when he started his work with the CIA. His name and his scandals involving the Phoenix program, the Golden Crescent, which again involved the same kind of things, and including heroin. And Jack Anderson actually was a reporter who exposed and covered all these scandals in 1970s that were related to these CIA operations in Vietnam and all the drug dealing and the dealing in heroin and, of course, Richard Armitage's role in this. In fact, these were so evidence-based, factual-based, and powerful that a few of his confirmations, and this is Richard Armitage in Congress, and we know how spineless the U.S. Congress is. Imagine how much it was, these scandals of his 1970s, that Congress actually put some of his confirmations on hold, because these were pretty known facts about Richard Armitage and his involvement in heroin and the Phoenix program. Then you fast forward and you come again to Richard Armitage's position with Reagan administration. And lo and behold, he shows up again right in the middle of, right in the thick of this whole Iran-Contra affair. Again, you're looking at the arms dealing. You're looking at the same elements as the scandals in 1970s. The scandals that involve arms and heroin and false flag, terror operations. And there he is again, Richard Armitage, right in the thick of it, in the middle of this. Then you look at 1990s, and the same thing, not only with Iran-Contra. Again, if you look at Richard Armitage's career, you see him linked exactly during the most sensitive period. You see him linked to Pakistan, okay? 1979 till 1983, 1984, his position again put him right in the thick of the midst of operations that we had with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and all the dealings that we had with Pakistan and Afghanistan, training and arming and dealing again in heroin with Mujahideens, this time again against Russia there. And there you see him again, his positions and the stuff he was involved with. And as I said, he shows up in the middle of Iran-Contra. Then if you fast forward and come to 1990s, his relationship and all these operations still continuing with Pakistan, but he starts getting involved with all the things that happened in the Balkans, with Kosovo and Bosnia. And again, the other two guys that you just named, Grossman and Halbrook, you see that's why I always look at them as a trio. You see the three individuals involved in all these things. Now, Grossman would have been too young. Grossman was not involved in the Phoenix program in Vietnam. But if you start going back in Grossman's career, you find him, his start with Pakistan and Afghanistan in 1980s, and then from there to Turkey. And of course, this was when his biggest position became the Operation B for Gladio. Back to Richard Armitage in late 1990s, This is after he and his Hal Brooks involvement, and Grossman was directly also involved with the Balkan operations. And we are looking at the shady, nasty side. Not that it wasn't all nasty, but this was when, you know, I just referred to it before, how we label people terrorists, and then we support them and they become our terrorists. We take the label off and they're no longer terrorists, they're allies. Well, this repeated itself, the same theme, the same MO with the KLA in the Balkans. This was when, again, Armitage, Grossman, Halbrook, these were the same guys who cut the deal and trained and supported KLA with all the drug operation and all the stuff that went on with the Albanians, okay, in the Balkans during the Balkan conflict. Okay, this was when for a period of time we removed, this is our State Department, the terrorist label from the KLA. Then we come towards the end of 1990s, and this is the biggest, the most important point as far as 9/11 is concerned, is PNAC, okay, and the Project for New American Century. And you look at the signatories and some of the most active people in writing, in drafting, and of course putting in force the in play the Project for New American Century PNAC documents, which is for me the most damning document out there. You are looking at, there he is again, Richard Armitage. So he was one of the PNAC signatories, but he was one of the top tier PNAC, because PNAC had three different tiers, levels of signatures. You're looking at the major top tiers, which Richard Armitage was part of, then the mid-level, and of course you're getting to some of the academics, such as, you know, Francis Ford Fukuyama, etc. So you see Richard Armitage there. Then you start moving forward post 9/11, and we had all the scandals with Scooter Libby, Valerie Plame, Joseph Wilson, that whole leak, or the so-called leak, that whole shenanigan. And lo and behold, in the end of it, he comes forward and he says, I was the one who leaked the name. I being the top person in the State Department who did this, okay, by his own admission. So that latest scandal we had in mid-1990s involving Wilson Plame brings the same name again, Armitage. And as I said, you know, it's always good to see the trio together, because you look at, as I said, with Mark Grossman, you see the same areas of concentration. You see, starting with Afghanistan and Pakistan in '80s, moving to Turkey, Operation B Gladio. You're seeing him with the European affairs with the Balkans. And then, of course, you see Mark Grossman even involved with the Valerie Plame, Scooter Libby scandal or shenanigan that took place. And not only that, when you're looking at some of the documented important facts on 9/11, pre-9/11, immediately after 9/11, you start seeing the same names. When you're looking, for example, at General Mahmoud, you will see the links between General Mahmoud and Richard Armitage. You will see that right on that day of September 11 attacks, or the same day or the next day, you're seeing this very secretive, mysterious meeting between Mark Grossman and General Mahmoud. And then fast forward that with Mark Grossman, with the Sunday Times articles and my testimony during this Krikorian case, Mark Grossman's role in nuclear black market dealings. And then you look at them after they give up their formal official positions, willingly. They are never kicked out, really. They willingly give up. You go and see which industries they enter, and then you start seeing the same lobby. Lobbies that are totally linked to, or directly linked to, Turkey and or Israel. I mean, in these cases, you will be seeing both Israel and Turkish lobby. And of course, all the other different lobbies connected to the military-industrial complex. Military-industrial complex, as we know, their entire existence depends on perpetual war. So we need to have terrorists, we need to have all this war, mujahideens and al-Qaeda's and bin Laden's, because without them, we won't have all these wars. And without all these wars, we won't have these guys with trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. So this was me trying to summarize it. I know it doesn't sound much of a summary, but I always see them as trio, because again, if you follow, as we just did with Mark Grossman, if you do the same thing and apply it to Hal Brooks, you start seeing exactly the same picture emerge here. You still start seeing the same heroin and terrorism and Mujahideen and KLA repeated theme for all three actors. Again, all three from the State Department with a very, very long and successfully held careers. Because another thing that ties these three people has to do with their importance and their role surpassing any administration. You can't look at them and say, oh, these are Republican right wings or these are liberal Democrats. They have, all three have been Clinton's guys, all three have been Reagan's guys, all three have been Carter's guys, and all three were actually heavily used and utilized by Bush guys. Because, you know, those are the puppets, Bush, Obama, Carter, Reagan. So it actually tells you who happened to be higher in the chain. And this is another fallacy that we have been trying to make people understand with their voting and what they think their voting is about. They think they are going and electing some decision makers. And this whole notion of the shadow government, who is the real government? Who are the real players? What do we mean when we say the establishment? We never mean Obama or Bush or Carter or Reagan. You got look beyond them and see who are the ones who always are there. Whenever we look, they are there. That's when you start seeing Brzezinski and you see Henry Kissinger and you see under them, you know, you start coming across people like Richard Pearl and Wolfowitz and Armitage. You're going to keep coming across the same players no matter whose administration you're looking at.
Exactly right. Well, again, this is a huge amount of information to synthesize. So why don't we concentrate and hone it down on 9/11 as specifically as we can? And you mentioned the meeting between Mark Grossman and General Mahmoud Ahmed in the immediate wake of 9/11. There was also a meeting between Richard Armitage and General Mahmoud at the same time. And I've seen conflicting sources. I've seen some say that this happened before 9/11, the meeting, and others that said it happened after. I would be
the Mark Grossman meeting actually took place exactly on the day of 9/11.
So that must have been after the breakfast meeting with
Porter Gross. They had a breakfast meeting, and in fact, there was even a hotel's name. And this was something that even that embedded journalist ended up confirming. What was her name? Judith Miller. So that breakfast meeting has been like a slam dunk case. It's something that has been established. Now, the meetings with Armitage, I am not sure about the dates on those meetings, but we know about that particular private meeting between, and it was not even within the government agencies. They held the meeting in this hotel. I forgot if it was the Willard's Hotel or one of the similar hotels near the White House, but that was when the meeting took place between Mahmoud and Mark Grossman. And you know, you brought up something very important, and I want to talk about something that may not sound as relevant until I finish, maybe, and that has to do for some people who do not really look at the significance of PNAC, okay, and the investigation that never took place with 9/11. And one of the things that I do, you know, my bachelor degrees were in criminal psychology and criminal justice, okay, and when you look at the criminal laws, okay, let's say you have a case, you have a murder case, okay, that you're looking at. And here is this, let's say a 68, 70 years old guy who's murdered. And let's say there was a big, ginormous life insurance on this guy. One of the first things you do is you look at people with motives, okay? You bring all those people initially as suspects until one by one you take them out of the suspect list. This was a criminal terror attack here, okay? That process never took place. Because if that process had taken place just by itself with PNAC and with these guys, we would have seen the initial, at least the initial bucket of suspect list until they were excluded, if they were excluded, to include these people. Because what happens if there is a letter, okay, from example that I just gave, the 68-year-old guy who's been murdered, and the wife or someone related to him who can benefit from greatly from this life insurance before this murder took place has put in letter about why this guy needs to die, okay? I mean, this is a very good parallel example to say, in order for me or for us, let's say there's a group of individuals or correspondings in letters, for us to do this and have this money, this man, this bastard must be killed or must die, okay? Imagine if a police finds a document like this. And then imagine the police not interviewed the people who wrote these letters, okay? And this should not be looked at, 9/11, any different than a criminal, a simple classic criminal investigation. When you go and read, and when you look at the emphasis place, and you would think, are they stupid enough to put it in a letter that we need a major terror attack here at home for our points, for our principles to be exercised, you know, and for the U.S. to become an empire, this event needs to take place. Well, yeah, there are people who are stupid enough who put it in letter and then commit murders. That's why they go to jail. But in this case with PNAC, you have this letter, you have these signatories, and they didn't only write it. They have been spending years working towards it, okay? And they not being some people on the sideline, you're looking at people within the United States government. They put together this letter, okay? And they work towards it. And 9/11 happens, and you have the police or FBI or all the other investigative forces not look at these people, even though just initially, as suspects, and get to the bottom of it and interview them and interrogate them and look at their background. I mean, let's say they did. They would have seen that meeting, okay, because it's a recorded meeting between Mark Grossman and General Mahmoud. General Mahmoud has already been established as one of the highly likely financiers of 9/11. Here is number three guy from the State Department on that day having this breakfast meeting, secretive, mysterious meeting with him. And then you're looking at this guy and his boss. They were signatories and they were the players with PNAC. Why didn't we have these types of investigations? Because even the stupidest police force would have conducted such investigations, and that did not take place. So that's why, you know, people say, oh, again, people are bringing up this whole thing of PNAC and these neocons, but I don't think they are looking at it the right way, or maybe some people are presenting some of these hard evidence facts maybe too complicated. So maybe it is important to kind of, because it's pretty simple. You have this letter that is highly suspicious. You have this document, PNAC. You have these players with the means and motives because they're indicating their motives, okay? And the murder, the terrorism, the criminal event has taken place, the same ones that have been sought by these people and have been worked towards. It is pretty simple because with all these criminal cases, and terrorism is a crime, okay? Murdering those people is a crime, and you have to look at it the same way as any criminal investigation, and that is the means. Has there been any, you know, premeditation? The means, the motives, and the beneficiaries, and none of these were ever asked with any of the investigations. Because you, even the investigators who have thrown out all the stuff, you know, with Bin Laden and these Islamists. If they have never put in any tangible way, they have put it in an abstract way, they have never put in any tangible way any kind of benefits. What is the tangible benefit they receive? Or the tangibly explained motive? But, I mean, and you compare that to PNAC and these players within PNAC, especially the top tiers, then you start looking at it in terms of tangible. Okay, something that you can really actually count, motive and means and benefits. And I always tell people, look at the benefits in terms of trillions, trillions and trillions of dollars for the military-industrial complex. And then you look at these individual signatories, especially the top tier, and see who do they work for. Okay, whether it's Pearl or it's Fight or it's Wolfowitz, they all end up with Lockheed Martin. You keep coming across the same names, whether it's the North Grumman or if it's Lockheed. So then you're looking at the dollars. Those are tangible numbers. Without 9/11, how much would they have made? Let me put it that way. With 9/11 happening, how much money they have been making? That's one, okay? They are saying these are their indicated goals very clearly on the paper. Without 9/11, how many of those goals would they have been able to accomplish? With 9/11, how many of those goals they accomplish?
Well, again, that is in black and white in the Rebuilding America's Defenses document that was released by PNAC one year before 9/11. But specifically also, Armitage was specifically a signatory to the 1998 letter that was urging Clinton to invade Iraq and to get Saddam Hussein. And then we found that in the months preceding 9/11, according to the Philip Giraldi article in the American Conservative, who's afraid of Sybil Edmonds, it was Scowcroft, Armitage, and Grossman were negotiating for a possible Turkish protectorate as sweetener for using Turkey as a staging ground for an invasion of Iraq in the lead up to 9/11. And then after 9/11 took place, that deal was basically off the table, and Scowcroft turned against the invading Iraq, but basically only because his connections in Turkey obviously were not for it in that eventuality. Unfortunately, I can't believe it, we're already kind of running out of time, but there's something else that I definitely wanted to touch on in relation to this, and it's the State Department's role in helping to secure the visas for the terrorists or the alleged hijackers of 9/11, which created, of course, the entire situation, or at least the possibility for it.
I can easily answer that question, because this is something that I can provide under oath. If I always hope to be asked under oath, because under oath, when you do that, you know that the government will be after you as someone who has committed perjury if you lie or if you even misrepresent something. But we have several cases, and some of this totally under my direct experience, because I was the person who was processing those files, okay, with detainees in New Jersey that involved individuals from Uzbekistan and from Turkey who were legitimately high-level 9/11-related suspects. And they were rounded up by the local field office. This is the FBI's local field office for those reasons. And they were held, and they were being interrogated. The diplomatic community for Turkey actually directly, and again, this is from 100% direct experience, they directly contacted Grossman in the State Department, gave them the names of people that they knew were held by the FBI, because they were notified. Some of these people, they get a right to go and ask for attorneys or to notify family members. And as soon as that took place, Mr. Grossman pressured the FBI's, not the field office, the FBI's headquarters and Washington field office, saying this would cause some diplomatic incidents. There are some diplomatic sensitivities involved in this, and what we are instructing you to do, no further questioning. We want you to deport them back, both of them, not one to Uzbekistan, one to Turkey, both of them. We want you to put them on the plane immediately, to be executed immediately, and send them to Turkey as deportation, as something under INS back then, the Immigration Department. So, and this caused an uproar within the New Jersey field office for the FBI, counterterrorism agents who were in charge of this. But these individuals who were of some value, because on the other hand, the same FBI, they needed to meet this quota both for the media, but also for congressional budget requests. They needed to meet this quota saying how many people they rounded up and detained. So they were detaining pizza delivery guy who was, let's say, from Afghanistan or Turkey. I mean, they want agents to round these people up, bring them into these different field offices, hold them there. And FBI field offices, they were exasperated. They were angry because they knew that they were chasing the goose, and that was taking away from the resources, the time and energy to go after the bad guys. Yet FBI wanted to show that today we rounded up, 800 people in New Jersey. I'm just throwing a number. So this is while this is happening. Yet they were able to detain two people of high value, okay, in terms of information, because I was assigned to translate their interrogation. These people did not speak fully, fully speak English. And these people, per direct instruction from the State Department, this was official, this was not on the side, by Mark Grossman, who was tipped off by the Turkish diplomatic community to no further questions for them. You are going to deport them based on visa violation, send both of them to Turkey. I'm sure they were sent to some other jihadi missions against Russia or someone through Chechnya and Azerbaijan after that. as part of the same operation we discussed, Operation Gladio, Operation B. But this took place within the first 2 weeks after 9/11. And this directly involved Mr. Grossman. Am I willing to testify on this under oath? Yes. Will I be willing to even take something that I totally despise, this machine called polygraph machine? Yes, because am I able to give the file, the exact names of the detainees, the file number, the FBI field office file number to whoever is investigating, let's say if someone is investigating this? Yes. Did I provide this to 9/11 commissioners? Absolutely. I was inside the SCIF with them for 3 hours. And because it was a SCIF, this is a secure compartmentalized information intelligence facility, I was able to give them the detainees' names, the location, the officer's name. These are the FBI agents. Did I give this stuff to the Senate Intelligence Committee? Yes. Did I provide this to the Senate House Judiciary Committee? Yes. I gave all the stuff in 2002 to all these people, and later in 2004 to the 9/11 Commission. Not only they have this, let's say this is allegation, but they have the corresponding file number, name, date, agent's name, field office, and the detainees' names and their exact nationality and their documentation, or what they didn't have in terms of documentation, because that's how they were deported back to Turkey per instruction from Mr. Grossman from State Department. He was the number three guy in the State Department at the time.
Sibel, this is mind-blowing information, but I'm afraid I absolutely have to go at this point. So I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for now. But I hope that we can follow up on this information and talk more about some of these characters, because, again, there's so much that needs to be uncovered here. But, again, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there.
Anytime. Just let me know and we'll do it, James.
Excellent. And I will direct people once again to Boiling Frog's post, where you have information on all three of these characters in various capacities. So we will leave that there for now. Sibel Edmonds, once again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.